From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court pulls the drain on the Environmental Protection Agency's overreach on wetlands regulation as a new analysis warns of a risk of widespread electricity blackouts and brownouts this summer. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnists Alicia Finley and Kim Strassel. Let's start at the Supreme Court. There is a landmark case there on the Clean Water Act and a significant controversy over the last several years involving the waters of the United States. Alicia, can you give us a sense of what this ruling was about and the significance of it?
So this ruling was about the Clean Water Act. It's a 1970s era law that allows Congress, or in this case, Congress delegated its power to the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to essentially regulate interstate commerce, navigable waterways, which are defined as the waters of the U.S. It's a very kind of amorphous term. And over the last several decades, this has been litigated. What does waters of the U.S. mean? How far is its scope? Again, the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have generally interpreted their authority very broadly and have steadily encroached on more and more land, not just wetlands initially, but then they start to interpret it to mean, oh, say, land that could temporarily fill with water during floods, or, you know, ditches, drains, and such. And this was particularly pernicious under the Obama administration. And they adopted opinion by Justice Anthony Kennedy in the case known as Rapinos in 2006 that gave the EPA the authority to regulate any land or water. It doesn't actually have to be wet. That has a significant nexus to another body of water that it can regulate. And this was, again, it's very amorphous. What does that mean exactly? A significant nexus. The EPA has interpreted it, again, very broadly. This went back and forth with the Trump administration, rolled back much of the Obama rule, but then the Biden reimposed it. And that was basically the core of the issue in this case, is the extent to which the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers can regulate land or water that isn't even water. In this case, there was a couple, Michael and Chantel Saquette, who have been trying to build a home on property in Iowa near Priest Lake for 16 years. And when they start construction and move dirt on their land, the EPA basically swooped in and said, you need to get a permit for this. And they actually, this case has already actually gone up to the high court before, in which they argued that, you know, they should be able to challenge this before actually being penalized. And so this is actually the second time that they've actually been up to the Supreme Court to challenge the EPA's authority or the overreach. And so at the very root, this is a case about, you know, both the separation of powers in terms of how broadly the administrative state can regulate without an explicit delegation or explicit authority from Congress. And then, of course, you know, federalism, because states traditionally have the authority to regulate these lands within their borders that are involved in interstate commerce.
The keywords in the Supreme Court's previous cases on this topic, and Alicia said them, but they're significant nexus. So this is a couple in Idaho. They purchased this lot near Priest Lake and were going to build a home on it, started backfilling the property. I'll read a line from the majority opinion here by Justice Samuel Alito. He says, according to the EPA, the wetlands on the Sackett's lot are adjacent to, in the sense that they are in the same neighborhood as, what it described as an unnamed tributary on the other side of a 30-foot road. That tributary feeds into a non-navigable creek, which in turn feeds into Priest Lake, an interstate body of water that the EPA designated as traditionally navigable. And so according to the EPA, that means that the lot owned by the Sacketts is in a significant nexus with Priest Lake. But it's a little game of leg bone connected to the arm bone here. Yeah, you have wetlands on their property, a 30-foot road, then an unnamed tributary, then a non-navigable creek, then Priest Lake. And if you start getting that far from the actual authority in the law of the law passed by Congress to regulate the waters of the United States, the navigable waters, then you start to wonder how far that EPA authority does go. And Alicia, does the majority pare back that interpretation of significant nexus? And also, now I note that it's a 5-4 opinion here. Justice Brett Kavanaugh breaking with the majority? And what was the standard that he wanted?
So all nine justices ruled for the Sacketts and said that the EPA doesn't have their authority to regulate this land or require that they get permits to move some dirt on their land. And actually, all nine justices disagreed with the significant nexus test, which isn't actually terribly surprising, because if you go back to the Rapinos opinion in 2006, the significant nexus was really a lone opinion by Justice Kennedy. The liberals didn't join in, the conservatives repudiated it. And the conservatives in this case, five of them at least, again, we can get to Justice Kavanaugh's opinion later, but five of them basically adopted the conservative plurality's opinion in Rapinos, which would allow the EPA to regulate the waters of the relatively permanent standing or continuously flowing bodies of water, such as oceans, rivers, and lakes, and then wetlands that were directly adjacent and indistinguishable from those waters. Now, where Justice Kavanaugh sided with the liberals is he thought that the adjacent should be read or interpreted much more broadly, and that it doesn't have to mean directly adjoining, and that he thought that, well, adjacent could mean a dictionary definition, close by, neighboring, or nearby. You know, it doesn't have to actually touch. And so there was a disagreement between the five conservative justices and then the liberals and Justice Kavanaugh on what exactly the word adjacent should mean. And I think the conservatives came out on the right end of this in terms of, like, there would be no limiting principle if you were to define adjacent as anything that was close by or nearby. That means the EPA could essentially regulate any land or water that it wanted to. It just had to say, well, this is close by an ocean. This is, you know, nearby Lake Michigan. And this could actually be much more broader authority than even the significant nexus standard.
Kim, a lot of the analysis or the coverage of this opinion have said that it's a loss for the Clean Water Act, a danger to America's waters. But to me, this looks like one of those cases about who decides. And there's nothing about this that precludes state regulators, which have broad authority over the waters in their lands. And by the way, a real interest in keeping those lands clean, since they're the people who are actually living around these rivers and wetlands and lakes that we're talking about often. There's nothing that precludes them from making more stringent standards, passing environmental laws through those state legislatures. And also, there's nothing that prevents Congress from giving the EPA more power if it thinks the EPA needs that power. What we don't want is to have a broad language passed by Congress, waters of the United States, navigable waters, and then to have the EPA or another agency aggrandize their power and be making decisions that they are not really authorized to make.
To be clear, the hysteria that you are hearing from many on the left is exactly that. It's just hysteria. You know, the Clean Water Act has been on the books for half a century. The United States has made massive progress using it to clean up some waters in the country that really did deserve some attention. That's a very different question from what's happened over the last 10, 15 years, where this was just a land grab by the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, perpetrated by Democratic administrations and bureaucrats that wanted to extend their reach. We're talking about tens of millions of acres that they were saying that they had enforcement authority over when the clear text of the Clean Water Act did not really do that. Now, I understand how they managed to get away with it because of some of these opinions, as Alicia mentioned, Rapinos, in which Kennedy put forward this very murky standard that bureaucrats then drove a bulldozer through. But all we are having here is the Supreme Court putting people back in their lanes, just as they did last year with the West Virginia EPA decision with regard to power plants, telling bureaucrats that there are limits to what you can do. And indeed, as you just said, Kyle, that if you don't like those limits, then you need to go to Congress and have Congress rewrite the law. And Congress can do that if they think it's necessary. I think that the necessary thing is really important, because one of the points that comes out of this Alito decision is that the way that the EPA was interpreting this really was exerting authority over areas of land that are not wetlands, okay? You have a soggy backyard for a season because it was wet that year. Somehow the EPA was saying that that made it the case that you had wetlands in your backyard and you couldn't do anything with your yard. And to be clear, just how corrosive and punitive these standards are. When the EPA exerts authority, you basically can't do anything with your property. Okay. You can't build, you can't backfill, you can't use herbicides, you can't use Roundup on your weeds. It suddenly is this protected area and the permits are not given out for the most part. So yeah, if you don't like it, go to your state legislature, go to Congress, ask them to rewrite it. But nobody can fault the Supreme Court for saying, hey, this is what the law says, stick to the law.
So Kim, does this Supreme Court decision, do you think, obviate the need for any kind of legislation? Or are clearer definitions from Congress still useful? And I would note that one of the Republican permitting bills that was recently introduced, this one is the Restart Act, has some more clear and specific definitions for some of these things. So skipping over some legalese here, for example, it says an adjacent wetland is a wetland that touches at least one point or side of a body of water or is inundated by flooding in a typical year from that body of water or is physically separated from that body of water only by a natural berm or an artificial dike, something like that. And so, Kim, I think the regulatory agencies often overstep, and the EPA probably did here, but it is also true that part of the problem is that Congress originally passed, as it is in the habit of doing, these statutes with unclear and vague language, such as waters of the United States. And now here we are, and the agencies are running with that as far as it will go. And we're here in court now trying to rein them in, whereas maybe what we really need are some specific definitions like what is in this permitting bill.
Clear language is always appreciated from Congress. It's just not very good at it and hasn't been good at it for decades now. And I think this is part of the message from the Supreme Court is do your job. We've seen a tendency, especially in the last decade again, for Congress to sit back, often purposely under Democratic majorities, write very vague statutes because they want the bureaucrats to have the ability to then define them the way they want to because they know the administrative state is largely on their side. So yes, more specific language would be good. I am doubtful that may happen only because this permitting reform that you were talking about, while there is a little bit more bipartisan interest in it these days, there's still a lot of progressives that would reject any of that outright because they want, again, the administrative state to be able to exert authority over basically any piece of land in the country. All that being said, I would also point out, though, that one problem, especially with prior courts, is that even when Congress is pretty clear, things can still get muddy. And I would encourage people to go read Clarence Thomas's dissent in this piece, which basically makes the point that once the courts actually kind of sign on to something, even they are wary of rolling it back. And, you know, he notes that the operative text in this operative law is the word navigable waters. That does not necessarily include wetlands, even if they are touching navigable waters. And he would have gone much farther. Gorsuch joined him in that in saying that actually, Congress said you can only regulate navigable waters, not the things near them, adjacent, touching, etc. Now, I would wager that the reason you didn't get 5 votes for that is that even Alito and Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett probably weren't willing to go that far, to be that far of a rollback of where we have landed at the moment. But that's kind of a pity. That was the pity to me of the decision is that as good as it is, it's not really going back to the real text of the Clean Water Act. And so I think the lesson here is Congress needs to be more clear from the start. Sometimes it needs to actually go out of its way to define what things really mean on top of the words. And maybe we could avoid some of these issues going forward if it was a little bit more proactive on that front.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access. Only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. A report last week issued by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation has a warning about electric reliability this summer. It says two-thirds of North America faces reliability challenges in the event of widespread heat waves. And I've seen some reports that that would include something like 165 million people. Alicia, can you give us a sense of what is behind this? And how worried should Americans be as we kick off summer with Memorial Day and start getting these hot temperatures that are going to cause people to crank up their AC?
So last year, actually, the NERC, which is for short, issued a similar report warning about two-thirds of the country could face reliability challenges depending on what the weather is. So this report, in some ways, it's a little more grave. In some ways, it's a little less. It actually says that certain areas of the country are in a better position than they were last year. For example, California is in a better position than it was last year because it has more hydropower, and the storms that really hit the state this winter improved its hydropower, which can contribute 10 to 15% of its supply and is able to kind of ramp up on demand in the evenings when the sun goes down. So it's known as kind of a dispatchable power source. So California is in a better position. Some areas in the Midwest are in a better position because the transmission line that was under construction last year is back up. But in some ways, actually, the NERC warning is actually a little more grave because you've had more coal and natural gas plants closed down in the last year. And some of that is because of regulation. Some of that is just because they're having trouble competing with heavily subsidized renewables. And I would actually add nuclear plants have also closed down, and those provide a steady baseload source of power. And so some areas of the country, in particular in the Midwest, may actually experience more issues. Texas, again, two areas of the country last summer that actually almost experienced blackouts were California. They had to resort to some emergency measures, and Texas, which also had to call or lean on businesses to reduce their operations at a certain point last July. Now, Texas has actually, you know, increased its solar generation and its wind generation in the last year. But the problem with that is, of course, that you can't count or rely on solar and wind in summer. And actually, in the summer, there are a lot of really hot, still days. And that's a refrain you see across the report, is that there should be ample power unless there's no wind. I mean, because wind in particular in the Midwest and Texas is generating a larger and larger share of the power, it's making the grid more vulnerable when you have those kinds of days, which often occur in the summer. And so Texas, is the worry there is that you could have more of these really hot, still days. And if there were to, say, a few natural gas plants overheat, and that actually does happen, is that some fossil fuel and or even nuclear plants will have issues when it gets really hot, in part because they're ramping up so and have to produce so much power. If a few of those go down, then you may either have to, again, lean on businesses to cut back, or there could be power outages.
But that framing "will be fine unless we have a whole bunch of hot, still days" strikes me as a pretty big unless. And for many people, a power outage, even if it goes on for hours or a day or a couple days, is an inconvenience. But for others, it's much more than that. I mean, if you're someone who relies on medical equipment to stay alive, a power outage could be catastrophic. And the point about the advantage of fossil fuel power is when you have a break in the sun or the wind like that, you can turn the dial up on the natural gas plant or the coal plant, and you can fill that need. And Kim, seems to me that some of this transition that we're going through in terms of electric power is predicated on storage technologies, battery technologies that don't exist or are not in place yet, at the very least. And so I get that NERC has been saying this for a while now. There have been other reports issued also by some grid operators saying similar things. and it gets very little attention. But I'm wondering if we are just walking into a really big problem that could shake up the political environment this summer if we get that kind of a blackout.
Yeah, of course we are. Look, this is entirely predictable. And no one can say that they aren't being warned about it. As you note, NERC has been putting out these warnings. Everybody in the power industry understands the problem, what's going on. Alicia just described some of this, but we've got renewables that are being heavily subsidized by government. It's closing down the necessary backup fossil fuel plants we need because they can't compete. I think that right now, for various reasons, something like a quarter of our current coal-fired power is set to go offline over the next 5 years. And yet we have an administration that just put out new power plant rules that would essentially make it impossible to bring on new natural gas or other fossil fuel plants that are, again, necessary backups for these renewables. Until we one day magic up the ultimate storage facility, which we are many years from being able to do, this isn't going to work. And the other thing that I think is very concerning is that while we are sort of slow walking every year, this is becoming more and more problematic. Once this moment happens, and once you have these massive blackouts across the country, there's no quick fix to this, okay? It takes a long time for a power plant to go offline, and it takes a long time to get one back on. So yeah, let's hope it does draw some attention, because one of the most mystifying things to me is that this administration can just keep putting out these ideas and policies and catering to the progressive left and in a way that's totally unrooted from reality and practical needs. And at some point, that practicality is going to hit the wall and Americans are going to be hugely inconvenienced, if not worse, and somebody's going to have to answer for it.
Alicia, we'll give you the last word, but it seems to me there are also a bunch of knock-on effects. If people start to get the feeling that the electrical power that they've been relying on is not going to be there always when they flip the light switch, one of those just might be different arrangements in how people run their businesses, whether they keep more inventory on hand, whether they keep less inventory on hand, whether if it's frozen or refrigerated stuff that they're selling, and investments that are basically losses because they're investing against something that shouldn't have to happen. And another one is generators. There have been news stories about people in California where there have been blackouts and brownouts due to wildfires, buying backup generators, and a lot of them run on gasoline. And then you're transitioning to green power and the power goes out and everybody fires up their gasoline generator, which is hardly efficient either. And so, Alicia, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but it strikes me as a real problem if one of the basic functions of government, which is to keep the power on, it starts to look and feel like to people like it's optional.
Well, there's a school of thought on the left that the electricity is a luxury and that we need to discourage consumption. People use more electricity because some households have two refrigerators. People just need to consume less. We need to get used to having smaller homes, you know, using less air conditioning, keeping your thermostat at 78 because humans are essentially menaces to the environment. I'd also point out, just on your point on the electric generators, that is an issue in California. They were actually sold out a year or two ago when there were wildfires, and all of a sudden all the utilities were having to cut power because of high winds and the threat to the grid. And so there's actually been pretty high demand for emergency generators in California, though, of course, the state has now banned them. There's a phase-in period, but another 5 or 6 years, you will not be able to get them. So get them while you can. They are encouraging, California is encouraging people instead to buy batteries. And in fact, it's now considering a mandate that electric vehicles in the state come with two-way charging. And what this is essentially is that the electric vehicles, Teslas, Ford, F-150s, be able to remit the power that they store back to the grid. So that is perhaps a selling point for some of these electric vehicles in California. Well, that you may be able to either run your home if the power goes out, But on the other hand, it may be essentially confiscated by the state in order to keep the entire grid up. It's definitely a business burden in a way, but it's also a business opportunity for some of these companies like Tesla, which is just making a killing, selling its batteries and both batteries to homeowners to keep their power on when there's blackouts, but also to the grid. And Tesla, again, is one of the biggest manufacturers of these, you know, grid scale batteries. And so in a way, it's actually just a payoff to these renewable companies, which, by the way, are also receiving heavy or huge subsidies under the Inflation Reduction Act.
Thank you, Kim and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.